Hi, everybody. This is Emily Trenum, the host of Memphis Metropolis. I'm away from the microphone this week, so we're rebroadcasting one of my favorite episodes. Hope you enjoy. Welcome to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. I'm your host, Emily Trenum. Memphis Metropolis is all about our city as an urban place, including its neighborhoods, buildings, pathways, and parks, as well as the people who shape it. Join us each week as community leaders and commentators talk with me about our shared built environment. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. Based out of Crosstown, and I'm Emily Trenum. I'm the Memphis Metropolis host. So this program, we have a very special guest, which is Vance Lauderdale, longtime columnist for the of the Ask Vance column at Memphis Magazine, and also a frequent contributor on all subjects Memphis, including a lot of things that are near and dear to my heart about the built environment. So Vance, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you write a lot in your column, and then I have the first one of your books, and we'll talk about those in a minute, about the Lauderdale family. And so, just give me a little backstory about, the Lauderdales, obviously a very, very esteemed name, along with the great names of family names of Memphis. But I don't know much about the Lauderdales. So what can you tell me?
Well, you don't know a lot about them because we kind of keep a low profile now because we're sort of embarrassed that we're not where we used to be. The Lauderdales are clearly one of Memphis's oldest and wealthiest and most famous families. And, not that many years ago, we hobnobbed with the Overtons and the Winchesters and the Crumps and the big names of Memphis. And our mansion was the scene of many parties. And not many people know that, like the Peabody, when they built the Peabody, the Versailles room in the Peabody was actually modeled. It's a smaller model of the ballroom in the Lauderdale Mansion. And the lobby of the Peabody is actually a pretty close copy of the Lauderdale living room. We didn't have ducks, though. They were just too much trouble. But at any rate, we were very well known. There's streets out named after us. There's a school named after us. And we were famous. The trouble is we invested unwisely in some ventures. We opened a dirigible factory. Little known fact, the Hindenburg was actually one of our products, but we don't like to brag about that one since it, didn't end well. And then we got into linotype machines because we thought that was the wave of the future. We saw a hot press going and we thought that's better than, writing with a pen. So we got into linotypes, and who knew that one day nobody would be using linotype machines? And then we bought hundreds of thousands of acres of flax farms. My grandparents did that. Honestly, I don't know what flax is, and I think that's the problem. I know it's somehow made into linen, but I didn't know how to do that. So, and neither did my parents. So we lost a lot of these ventures. And then, of course, the IRS came calling, and my parents went to prison. The Shelby County Child Services then came to the mansion to take care of me, but left when they discovered that I was 27 years old and they thought I could get by on my own. So I've been living in the mansion by myself for, 40 years now. But I needed some income. Or at least the people who continued to work for me thinking they would get a paycheck, my butler and my chauffeur, they needed some income. So I decided I can't remember if they approached me or I approached them, but at any rate, I started writing a column for Memphis Magazine. Actually, let me back up. Actually, it started
in
the flyer.
So hold on a minute, though. I'm not done with the Lauderdales. So you still live in the Lauderdale mansion, and I know we don't want to say where that is because, you know, for your own safety, I know that, you know, people would come calling with their questions they needed urgently answered in the Ask Fans column. But the, did you have, were there other family members? Did you have, brothers and sisters or anything like that?
We had, I did have some younger brothers, but we sold them, to gypsies because we needed the money. And so I'm the last of the Lauderdales.
So do you still entertain in those, in the ballroom? And it sounds like a lot to keep up. I know you do still have, you know, a butler and a chauffeur, but it sounds like even with that small staff, it would be difficult to keep that property up.
We've had trouble. The fire department finally shut it down and said, no, you can no longer have any social events here. It's a hazard. And I'll occasionally post pictures of the mansion showing it in various stages of disarray. But I basically just live in two or three rooms. I'm in one of them right now. So I don't need the whole thing. And yeah, people ask all the time, where can we still visit the mansion? And especially because I refer to a lot of my historical items as part of the Lauderdale Library, I do have a vast archives, but those aren't open to the public. Too many things were getting stolen, and it's just too much trouble. I stay working all the time, so I don't have time for visitors.
Well, anyway, you were talking about how the Ask Fans column got started before I interrupted you and diverted you back to family history, which is extremely interesting. So how did the Ask Fans column get started?
Years ago, the public library used to have a department called LINC, Library Information Center, and anybody that had any questions about Memphis history could call them. And this was pre-internet. So these people did a fantastic job of looking up this information. They'd often have to call back a few days later with the answers. But the other resource for that was newspapers and magazines around town. People figured, well, if these journalists may know something about Memphis, so they started to call Memphis Magazine with questions. They had noticed an old sign, an old building, a curious gravestone, something, and they would call us, and those questions would be passed on to our staff. And it finally dawned on them that some of these questions might be interesting to not just that person, but to our general readership as well. And so we decided way back in 1991 let's post some of these questions in the magazine and see what kind of interest it got. And this is 91 was pretty much pre-internet for our company. So the questions were either telephone calls or actual letters. And the column caught on like wildfire. One of the very first questions I remember was, if anyone's familiar with Midtown and drives down Peabody, there's a curious cast iron tower that stands at the corner of Peabody and Melrose. And people had asked about that tower. And so that was one of them that was given to me, find out what that tower was. It's an old ham radio.
I'm familiar with tower. It. I drive by it all the time. But I mean, why you? Why Vance? I mean,
well, they knew my family had been here, you know, 200 years or so, and they figured, well, maybe I already know the answers to these questions. That was their mistake. I didn't know them, but I knew how to find the answers. and they require a lot of, they require more research than I think a lot of people would imagine. I know some of them, people probably read the columns and think, well, this probably took him about 10 minutes. But some of these can take days. And
especially, you have to dig up, you know, paper. I'm sure that still sometimes entails going through file folders. Not everything is digitized.
No. And again, when the column started, there wasn't digital. But even though there is things like Google and all sorts of ancestry and those kind of websites, it's amazing the gaps that are there and how much just plain digging through old scrapbooks and photo albums and yearbooks and things like that that I do. So I've acquired those when I can because they're very important resources. But the other part of the column too is because it's in a visual medium, a magazine and a website, the art director wants pictures. So sometimes I'll have an answer, but I don't have a visual. And so I'm always digging through. I look at optionals. It's, you know, not just a photograph, but a restaurant menu, a matchbook cover, postcards, yearbooks. Yearbooks are good because they have ads for businesses in the back. And so often long gone businesses. So they're useful for research purposes.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because everyone knows about the Memphis and Shelby County Room and sort of your traditional places people to go to research historical things. But you must have a vast personal library of not only yearbooks, and you're always talking about city directories. I don't really even know what that is. Is that like a precursor to the telephone book?
It's a super telephone book. I was told they were made for salespeople, but they are. It's a telephone book that's divided into sections. They're annual, just like most telephone books. But they list people by name, and then they of course give the address and the phone number. But they also will provide that person's place of employment and even their title. Okay, that's the first half of the book. So then now that you know their address or something like that, you can go to the second half of the book, which lists homes, businesses by streets. So if you're curious, okay, I'm writing about such and such company. What was next door? What was across the street? What was down the block? And it just keeps going from there. You can look up other members of the family. You can look up again. The addresses are very interesting sometimes because you'll find a business, and then when you look up the street address, often there'll be a competing business right next door. Grocery stores are amazing to me in that regard, but especially in the early 1900s. You'll have a Piggly Wiggly, a Kroger, and a Super Saver, and another. You may have four grocery stores side by side. I don't know how a shopper decided, but walking down the sidewalk, a lot of people didn't have cars, which grocery store they'd go to. But city directories are incredible. And some of them are online, but the ones that are, the type is so small that, and it's sometimes just easier to flip through actual physical pages of a book than scrolling through a website.
When did they stop publishing those, roughly?
I have some that are in the 2000s, 2001. I don't, again, and as the city got larger, the books got larger. So they're like, the 2001 set is three volumes. One is by name, one is by street, and one is by, there's another category.
I had no idea. I had no idea they were published that recently. It sounds like it would be kind of got going down a rabbit hole, like you'd be looking something up and then you'd go here and there. And then 2 hours later, you've learned a lot of very useless information.
The astonishing thing is how far back they go. They go all the way. They go all the way back to like 1850. I mean, how in the world could you publish a city directory in 1863 in Memphis and during the Civil War? They're there. You can look up businesses in 1863. So that's an invaluable resource. the public library and the University of Memphis Library have them, the actual bound volumes.
So how do you...
And I get them online, too. I find them on eBay. I buy them. So I have my own collection here.
So just from looking at the visuals, it sounds like you must also have a big collection of, you know, just ephemera. I collect old Memphis postcards, but that's it. You know, no matchbooks and menus, but and I'm sure some of that comes from other sources, but it sounds like maybe the Lauderdale Mansion has a room or two dedicated to that kind of stuff.
Well, I have to tell you, when I started collecting actual physical objects, I wish I had put them in alphabetical order, come up with some file cabinets and started putting them in alphabetical order. Because now that I have thousands of things, I just have to dig and dig. And invariably, after I've done a column, that's when I'll think, oh, there's that postcard I've been looking for. So it's not as organized as it should be, but I don't have any assistance. That's the I'm sure people used to think I had a team. In fact, people used to ask if they could work for me, and that's all well and good, but I don't have any money. So they'd have to do it for free. And people have even offered to do that because they think it's fun. But I get out. It's not just books. I wander around cemeteries and drive around. Google Street View has made my life a little easier because I can tell in a glance whether it's worth driving all the way across town to take a picture of an old building. Too often it's just a parking lot, but Google Street View may tell me, oh, wait a minute, that does look like that used to be an old Piggly Wiggly or whatever. So I'll go take a look at it.
How do you decide what questions to answer? I mean, obviously some topics you've already done before, but what's that process like? Because you're only really writing one article a month, and there's got to be more than 12 questions that come in a year. It's got to be hard to select the right ones.
Well, when it started, I would keep the answers short because I would try to do 3 questions a month. But lately, you know, I've kind of run out of the easy questions. And I avoid questions of topics that you can find easily anywhere else. I'm not going to answer questions about the Civil War or Elvis, because you can find that anywhere. I also try to avoid sports because there are other people in town that know far more about sports than I do. But yeah, it's, I only answer maybe 1 or 2 questions a month online. I mean, in the magazine, but I do have a Facebook page where I'll post odd things that I've found. But also, I write sometimes directly back to people because people, let me just say, I'm such a Luddite that even email questions to me, I print out and punch holes and put them in a 3-ring binder so I can kind of keep track and write notes on that so I can like need a postcard or have a postcard or things like that so I can kind of keep track. But at any rate, when the column first started, as I said, it was mainly mailed letters to me, which are always interesting, handwritten letters, and telephone calls. But then when online stuff started and Facebook started, then I started getting questions from all sorts of sources. And I now have a backlog. You mentioned I only answer 1 a month. Well, that's part of my stress level. I have a backlog now of the last time I looked, 1,000 unanswered.
Oh, wow.
Questions. I've kind of become the go-to guy for weird stuff. They've already contacted other people, and those people direct them. Well, Vance will know this.
Well, that's sort of related to, I want to talk in a minute about, you know, some of your favorite questions over time, but what about questions that stump you? I'm sure there's some of those.
Well, what's funny about that is people have pointed out, they said, it's amazing. You answer every question. Well, I'm not going to post a question where I say I don't know the answer. So yeah, I have quite a few that sometimes I don't know what the question is. I can't figure out what the, I think some people just are writing me and I keep thinking, well, they're going to get to a question, but no, they're just sharing a memory without actually answering a question. And then, yeah, I have quite a few that I never just give up, but I will put it aside where it may then sometimes get lost. I have so many questions that it's more than my brain can handle. And what's kind of amusing to me anyway, is that I have more than once, at least on three different occasions, I can remember writing an answer or working on a column, and I'll get about almost two-thirds of the way through the column, and then I'll think, well, I need to double-check something. I need to double-check the fact. I'll see if it's online. And I'll do a Google search, and it'll pull up a column that I wrote on that exact same topic 5 years ago, well, 10 years ago. But I have no memory.
Well, there's so many. I mean, you need an index of some kind.
Yeah, but it's kind of depressing that I have no memory of already writing about that topic. And luckily the facts match, but then I'll have to kill that. Like, well, I can't run that story again. I have to find another one, but I have plenty to choose from.
We all suffer from that, so don't feel bad.
Yeah.
So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Memphis Metropolis and WYXR 91.7 FM, and we're talking to Vance Lauderdale, author of the Ask Vance column in Memphis Magazine. So let's talk a little bit about some of your favorite questions or some of your favorite, places. I mean, you do write a lot about people. You know, I'm a person who's I'm interested in people, but I'm very interested in places. And those are my favorites. I guess that's partly why I collect postcards. You know, the restaurants that no longer exist and the parks and the hotels. I mean, some of them do exist, but it's the places that really fascinate me. So I have a couple questions about that. So what are some places you've written about? A couple places that are long gone, but a lot of people remember them. And I'm thinking about like Fortune's Ice Cream Company, which of course is way, I don't even know when that was gone, but I think about places you see referenced that were iconic, but are long gone.
I've told people the two topics that seem to most interest my readers involve dining and dying. I get so many questions about restaurants. People have such fond memories of long gone restaurants. And then I get so many questions about curious gravestones people have come across. But back to the restaurants first. The Tropical Freeze that stood at the corner of Poplar and White Station is probably tied with the Luau, which was on Poplar Cross from East High School, as the most asked question. And I guess it's kind of discouraging because our readers don't read my column sometimes because they'll say, hey, Vance, have you ever written about the Luau? Yes, 10 times, but never enough to satisfy me. It's always just little bits and pieces because I've never found a good, clear color photograph of the Luau. You know, back in early days, people did not carry super high resolution cameras around in their purses and pockets. You carried a camera that had a 12 shot roll of film in it. And so you weren't going to take a picture of a restaurant, even if your family ate there. You weren't going to waste that film. So I've written about the Luau. There was another place out on Poplar past Estate, very popular in that area of town called Davis's White Spot, that you would see ads in yearbooks, especially White Station yearbooks, your schools out in East High School. And their ads would just have a black spot, a black circle and it would say Davis's white spot. And I'm thinking, well, that's not a white spot, it's a black spot. But I finally found somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody, and they put me in touch with a relative, and they sent me finally a photograph of the place. And it was just a wooden, looked like a farmhouse, very large farmhouse, but it was an incredibly popular restaurant in East Memphis. But those three, the Luau, Fortunes, oh, you mentioned Fortunes, all of the Fortunes, especially Fortunes Jungle Garden, that was torn down to make way for the expressway. It also had a couple of fires, which didn't help. But a lot of restaurants, people have fond memories in restaurants, and important events take place in restaurants. And I had mentioned that I sometimes respond to some questions personally when I have time, because some of these are so important to people that I can't put them off. I may not know the full answer, but enough to put it in the magazine. But somebody may write and say, you know, they've moved away from Memphis. A lot of my readers are people who no longer live in Memphis, but are curious about, you know, what are these places, landmarks important to my life, that are they still there? So I'll get a letter from somebody who says, my wife just died, and I'm just curious if the restaurant called The Stable is still standing, because that's where I proposed to her. I can't ignore a question like that. Come on, that's vitally important to this person. And I know enough about The Stable, and I do have some postcards and even a menu. So I'll, and maybe I've written, in fact, I have already written about The Stable, but I don't want to say, look, I've already written about that. Why didn't you read that? So I will write to that person and send him or her anything I have. So I get a lot of very personally important questions. One person wanted to know about Union Station. She told me a wonderful story about how she had corresponded with a guy fighting in World War II over in Europe. She had formed a mail by letter, just friendship with this guy, had never even met him, but he had proposed to her by sending her a wedding ring in a box of crayons, which used to come in a wooden box, mailed her a wedding ring. She accepted, but she still hadn't even met him. I mean, they exchanged photographs, but she hadn't met him. And so she told me this charming story about waiting nervously on the steps of Union Station for that train to arrive, for her husband-to-be to arrive. And she doesn't live here anymore and wants to know if Union Station was around. Well, I had to say, well, no, it's no longer standing, but here's a great photograph of it, and here are the steps where you surely stood. And then sometimes we'll get into correspondence with these people back and forth. You know, what happened? How's it going? You know, what did y'all end up doing after the war and that kind
of thing? Well, that's, I think, why I love places so much, because, you know, places are where people made memories, where they worked, where they, I mean, obviously that's a very momentous occasion, but places where people, like every family, every Friday night we went to this restaurant, my family and I. We didn't have a lot of money, but we went at every Friday night and we went to, and that's, yeah, I mean, Union Station is a great example. There's a couple of buildings that I would love to go back in time and see. And that's one of them for sure. And another one is the Memphis Steam Laundry, which might not been as grand in real life as it is in my beautiful postcard, but
it may have even looked better.
Could have been.
It was supposed the authors of Memphis and Architectural Guide basically said it's probably the most ornate laundry ever built in the country. It was designed after a Venetian palace. Come on. And then, of course, this being Memphis, they had to tear it down because it was in the way of something else they wanted to put up there, and they didn't have any need for it. But the Memphis Steam Laundry, yeah, this is the name of it. Doesn't sound very fancy at all. But you see the pictures of it, you think, what, is this some sort of government palace? So, yeah, I got quite a few questions about that. And then speaking of that, the building, the thing behind it, the landmark behind it, Russwood Park. A lot of questions about Russwood Park.
I bet. Luckily. Yeah, it was just, I have a Memphis Red Sox cap, baseball cap I was wearing last weekend. And of course, I would love to have gone to Rosewood Park. I'm a big baseball fan. So yeah, it's just the ability to go back in time and see some of these places, just really, I would love to. So, but what about places that are, you know, interesting places that are still around, but have been, you know, repurposed into another use? Anything like that that comes to mind that you're, people will say, like, what did this used to be? You know, right now it's a restaurant. And I'm thinking about that, you know, the Red Hook on Union, which is pretty new. Like, there's a restaurant, but what's the story with this building?
Yeah, that was the 19th Century Club, wasn't it? You can drive up, well, you can drive down Union, and the few big buildings that are still standing have all been repurposed into something. But I'll drive around. That I get questions from readers that will ask that type of question, especially. They will realize this used to be, but often they're not remembering them. They're not remembering the landmarks. They're remembering these oddball little chains, you know, that had distinct architecture. And some of these, you know, I can't keep them straight. But I know, for example, somebody had noticed an odd building out on Poplar, and they said, that used to be a Burger Chef restaurant. Everybody's heard of Burger King. I had to do a little bit of research to remember Burger Chef. And yeah, I found an ad in a yearbook. And yeah, they had these very bizarre buildings that you instantly recognize at the time as the Burger Chef. But this one had been repurposed. I'm not sure what it was now. You'll see Loeb's, especially the Loeb's barbecue places. They were all over town, and they had a very distinctive pig-shaped sign out front. And a lot of those buildings have been repurposed, but they've kept the sign. They've repainted over it, but it's still a pig shape. And so people wonder, like, was this a barbecue restaurant? So I'll get a lot of questions about that.
I think there's...
But I'll tell you one of the strange, if you want, one of the, I get, you know, some of the questions I think, I already know this one, or I've already answered this, but I do get a couple of questions that, I mean, I think I know Memphis, and then I'll get a couple of questions sometimes that will just blow my mind, because it's like, how did I not know this? And I'd like to tell you about just one of them that just rattled me, because I got a letter that said, what is with the castle on this street in Southeast Memphis? That's all it said, castle. And this was pre-Google, so I had to drive over it. And in this particular neighborhood, it was sort of a blue-collar neighborhood. So it was small ranch-style homes lining the streets. And I anticipated seeing where somebody had just sort of embellished their home with castle-like, you know, put up a little plywood turret or something, or something that, you know, my mouth dropped open. I went back to work just shaking my head thinking, oh, what in the world? So I'm driving down the street, and there's a castle on the street. It takes up the whole lot. It is a concrete and stone castle, with the tower and the battlements and the turrets and even a huge drawbridge, no moat, so the drawbridge didn't serve any purpose, but the drawbridge even had giant chains coming out of slots, so it looked like it could be lowered. It had slots for the people to shoot the arrows. But here's the great puzzle. There is not a name on this building. There is no street address. There is no driveway. There is no parking lot. There's nothing. It's just a castle. Now, down the street, there's some people standing in the front yard, and I just asked them. I introduced myself. And I said, I'm just wondering about this castle down the street. And they said, what castle? And I said, well, the castle right here. And they said, we don't know what you're talking about. And then other people in the area, quote, didn't know what I was talking about. And there's a church on that same block. So when I got back to the office, I told people, I've said, I've really got, there's something really weird going on. So I called the church, and they even said, we don't know what castle you're talking about. And it's like, well, okay, people don't want to talk about this place. Why would they not want to talk about it? What is it? Some secret lodge or what? It took forever, but I finally got in touch with somebody who knew the owner. And I finally got him on the phone. And he said, oh, it's just a little store I opened. I said, what kind of store? He said, just a little sundry store. That was a term they used to use. And I said, well, what do you sell? He says, oh, you know, I've got cigarettes. I've got candies, packets of candy for the kids that come in, cigarettes, and maybe some bread. And I said, so you have a store that has no name, no street address, no parking lot, no driveway, no nothing. And you're still going to tell me it's a store? He goes, that's what I'm telling you. So I don't know. I didn't know what to make of that. I took pictures of it. I ran pictures. People said, what in the world? I'm going to go see this myself. I said, well, okay, but don't go knocking on that drawbridge, because I don't think the owner really, there wasn't even a front door. But here's the curious ending to that story. About 10 years after that, a realtor called me and they said, you know, that castle you wrote about, it's for sale. I have it listed. And in fact, go to our website and you can see the interior, because I had asked the owner, I said, well, what's inside? He says, well, just the store. Well, they said, look at the interior. The interior, if the outside was a stone castle, the inside was a Persian palace. It was all gleaming white marble floors, walls. It had these very ornate wrought iron lamps and everything. And yet it had a store counter that sure enough had these dusty packs of bubble gum and cigarettes and some old loaves of bread. So it was a store, but now if you drive by it, they have converted it into a convenience store in all of its ugliness. It's got a big sign outside. It's got spotlights. It's got security cameras. It's got a parking lot now. So now it finally is a store, but I don't know what it was originally built for. But the point is that I get questions sometimes that completely stump me and blow my mind.
Well, did you write about it? I'd like to go back and read the article.
I wrote about it, and that's the problem. A lot of these stories are pre-internet, so you're not going to find that column online unless I reposted it. Some of them I'll repost, but that one, the other thing is I don't even know what I called it, because I didn't have.
That's really bizarre. So what do you think it was, like a house of ill repute, as they used to call things? I mean, what do you?
I think it was worse than that. I don't know. Obviously, the neighbors clearly did not want to talk about it, and even the church didn't want to talk about it. You think they might have, you know, complained, but they were basically, God, we don't know what you're talking about. Click. So, and now it seems to be a legitimate business, and it was probably a legitimate business then, but maybe the owner was just eccentric. I don't know, but that was one of the. That was one of those that people kept saying, what was that? And sometimes I don't have an
Well,
answer.
Does the column appear in any of your books? I saw something on Facebook that you might have a third book coming out, and I realized I only have the first one. So I need to get number two.
It may be in one of those books. What we did, after I'd done about 80 columns, I think I've done 300 columns. Started in 91 times 12. I guess that's about 300. But anyway, we decided to compile, we called it the best questions and answers from Memphis Magazine's history and trivia expert. And so I picked out about 60 columns, maybe 70, and put them in a book. And then that book sold out. That surprised me that so many people wanted it that quickly. And I had a huge book signing at Davis Kidd at the time. there must have been a line out the door. It was stunning. So after a while, we waited, and then we did book two, which we very cleverly, brilliantly called More Questions Than Answers. Not better. Here's some more. Here are leftovers. And those were the next 70 or something columns. But that book, that was some years ago. I can't remember the exact dates they came out. So we did a book, book one, did a book two. We had plans to finally do a book three, even though we'd have to really call, because by that time, more years had passed, and we wanted all the books to be about the same. But then COVID hit, and that kind of put a stop to a lot of things, a lot of projects. So that project's on hold now. And then again, you know, you have to face the fact that Memphis doesn't have as many bookstores as it used to. So we put book one on Amazon. And even the curious thing to me is you could buy a Kindle version of it. And I did buy a Kindle version just to see how it worked. It's pretty tricky to look at a big visual book like that on Kindle, especially back then they were just black
right.
and white.
Yeah, I can't imagine so that.
We didn't bother with that. And I don't know if we put book two on Amazon. I do know you'll see them on eBay quite frequently. But yeah, book one's gone. And we still have copies of book two. We will gladly sell you. And book three?
Maybe someday. Maybe
somewhere.
Yeah, someday. I need to get book two. Yeah. I'm going to look at book one and see if there's the article about the castle. That is so interesting.
Yeah, I can't remember if that's in book one or book two. Book two I liked better because I got to focus a lot more profiles on well-known people. A lot of Memphians remember a guy named Mario who ran a pizza parlor over on Park Avenue, and eating there was quite an experience because Mario would sit at your table and tell the most amazing stories. He had been a professional bicycle racer in Madison Square Garden. He came over here from Italy. He claimed he invented pizza, which is an interesting claim. But Mario's, I found luckily a lot of good pictures of him at various stages of his career. And then Pappy's Lobster Shack, Happy Hal. I did a Trent Wood of Looney, who was the host of Looney Zoo. And that was a very popular column. That was one of the most popular columns I did because those are children's TV shows where you had children in the audience. And the sad thing about these TV, any column I write about TV shows is invariably out people that they remember this very specifically. They'll say, well, Vance, on April 23rd, 1957, my parents took me and I sat in the audience of Happy Hal show and watched it, you know, so where can I get a tape of that appearance? The TV shows back then, the TV stations, they did not tape things. They filmed them or they used some cheap tape and then they reused. They did not save anything. Even the famous Fantastic Feature show featuring Savant, somebody finally found an old intro tape for that they used for the commercials, but they did not film. He had a little 15-minute intro shtick. They didn't film any, they didn't save any of that. And that Savad is one of the most popular, famous characters in the history of Memphis.
Yeah, I'm not from Memphis. And so that was kind of lost on me. My husband has this little frame picture of Savad and I'm like, who's that? And it's, yeah.
Well, he was famous. His real name was Watson Davis, and he was the director of marketing for Malco Theaters. And he decided to create a vampire type character, kind of a combination of vampire and Frankenstein. And anyway, he just reversed the letters of his last name, Davis, to form Savad. And he was the monster of ceremonies for Fantastic Features. And you watch these shows today, they still have reruns somehow, even though they don't have the tapes. You can watch these shows today and you'll just look at them with a completely straight face, like, And yet, as kids, we were terrified. We were just afraid to go to bed after Savant had come on because we thought he would come into our house and, you know, kill us. But TV, I get a lot of questions about TV shows, and I'm not very helpful with them because the TV stations themselves at the time just did not archive their materials. Well, how could they? They were doing a show a day. Think of it. And you had eight tracks. I mean, not eight tracks, huge, large cassettes holding a half hour show. You had, even the Sears Crosstown building would fill up with those tapes after a while. So you had to.
So you occasionally, or maybe, you know, frequently, will do a longer feature and, you know, something that's a bigger subject, or sometimes where you have a lot of visuals. And you did one recently on the Sterrick building. And that must be great when you see, you know, places like that that are basically mothballed. And then, you know, that era ends and then it just unlocks a lot of very interesting history.
Oh, I love going in. I love exploring old buildings legally. I've had some unfortunate experiences exploring old buildings where I thought I was the only person in the building, and then heard noises or saw other people and thought, oh, I didn't know somebody was actually living here. I need to skedaddle. But in the case of the Sterrick building, the owner gave us a tour of it. Now, I've shared this story and I'll make it quick, but I was in one of the stairwells. It's a 29-story building, and it has many very ornate, very elaborate stairwells. And I went with about six other people, including the owner, and they scampered up the stairwells. But I saw something in one of the stairwells, a doorknob that I wanted to photograph because it's a very ornate doorknob. So I wanted to photograph. All I had was my iPhone. For some reason, even though we knew in advance the building had no electricity, I did not think to bring a flashlight. It's one of the stupidest things I've ever done because my friends were not interested in that doorknob. They scampered on up and left me behind. Well, then now I'm in a stairwell and all I have is my iPhone. And I do know that iPhones have a flashlight feature. My flashlight feature does not work. So after my friends went up the stairs a little ways, and they didn't have to go very far before I could not hear them.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, I'm in this dark stairwell and I kind of feel my way up to the next floor and open the door and look out, and they're not on that floor. And it's completely, even though the building has windows, when you're in the core of the building, it is pitch black. It's not a matter of like, well, I'll just wait here and my eyes will adjust to the light. There's no light. So I kept going up. First of all, I kept going up looking for my friends. And then I finally decided, well, I'm just going to creep back down. But even using just the light from my iPhone, just the screen, that didn't even reach the ground. So I was going down one step at a time and then with my hand on the railing, but also trying to remember when we came up, was the railing continuous? Because sometimes the railing would just stop. And then I would just have to pause and just kind of creep my way. I was in that dark stairwell. I mean, dark, for probably a half hour because I could not find my way out. Because the thing is, it's hard to explain, but the lobby level didn't enter. It came into the stairwell on three, and I went past three, down farther, which opened into the basement. So I kept going up and down, trying to find my way out. And I finally, just by guesswork, finally found my way out to the hallway that looks like if I go down this hallway, it will lead me to the lobby, where I then collapsed and stared in a chair until my heart stopped racing. Because the other thing I didn't mention is I'm claustrophobic. And then people, my friends, they went all the way to the roof. By this time, I was so exhausted and traumatized, I decided, no, I'll do this later. But my friends came back down and they said, well, why didn't you use your phone as your flashlight? I said, my phone doesn't work. Then they reminded me, they said, but you did have a phone. I said, well, yeah, but my light didn't work. They said, but you had a phone. You could have called us. And I realized, oh yeah.
Oh my.
See, my plan was to just sit in the stairwell till they came back down. But I wasn't confident they might come down that exact stairwell and no one would ever find me. That would be a fitting end for Vance to find his shriveled up carcass holding a working phone and thinking, why didn't he just call?
Instead of ask Vance, it would be, where's Vance?
What happened? Yeah. So, I've had some interesting experiences. I can't explain it. I think I saw a ghost at Elmwood, if you want to hear that story. It's eerie. Well, it's not a great ghost story. It was just so unsettling that I didn't know what to make of it. But I was looking. I go to the graveyards around here because I want to see some of these graves. People will often just mention it, a grave, without sending me a picture. It's like, come on, make my job easier. Attach a picture. So I'll go take the picture myself. But anyway, I was in a back corner of Elmwood one time where Elmwood's sort of hilly. So if you get back in the back, you're out of view of people. And I was back there all by myself. I'd found the gravestone and I was kind of studying it. And out of the corner of my eye, I see this gentleman walking towards me. And he's, I look at him just to make sure I'm okay. He's an older guy and he's dressed in a suit, coat, tie, jacket and everything. And he's walking in a completely straight line, which in itself is a little odd because most people dodge the graves. You know, you just don't walk over graves. He did, but because he was just making a completely straight line. And I kind of watched him. And then as he came up to me, without even turning to look at me, he said, nice day, isn't it? And I said, yeah. And then I watched him and he just kept going, just smooth as can be, walking. And then he went over a hill and he kind of went down where I couldn't see him anymore. Well, there was just something peculiar enough about him that I thought, I'm going to see where this guy's going. So I walked over that hill. He was gone. He wasn't there. And it, you know, I thought, well, where could he have gone? It was just a little unsettling. And then I finally got in my car and I drove up closer to the entrance where they were setting up a funeral. And I thought, was this guy walking towards his grave? I mean, it was just that eerie enough. He looked like he was dressed to be in a casket. Was he just walking? Nice day. Wow. For your funeral. It was a little, just sent little, you know, your hair is kind of.
So, I mean, I would have thought like, you know, Ask Vance was kind of writing that was kind of a desk job, but it sounds like really the Memphis Magazine ought to give you hazard pay.
Well, yeah, I get out. I do, like I said, I explore buildings. I need to see what's in them or what's behind them or what's around them. So I get out and I like to take my own pictures. And then I'm exploring a lot of cemeteries, There are lots of little cemeteries. One of the strangest ones is up in the northeast corner of Shelby Farms. There's a double gravestone just in the middle of the woods. Nobody seems to know anything about it. I haven't been able to do much about it. But it's a very ornate gravestone without any indication of what, you know, who were these people? I mean, their names are on it, but why are you buried here? And do people know about this? And I can't remember if I wrote about that one. But anyway, yeah, I get out. I get out. And then sometimes I regret, like, well, I can't walk up there anymore.
All right. Well, this has been a great, great discussion. So you've been listening to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. I've been talking to Vance Lauderdale, who is the longtime author of the Ask Vance column and writes other stories for Memphis Magazine. So Vance, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me. Appreciated it.
You've been listening to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. I'm Emily Trenum. Memphis Metropolis airs every Monday at 1, so please tune in again next week. You can listen to past programs on our program page at wyxr.org or on memphismetropolis.com. You can also follow us and send feedback on social media. Now, stay tuned for Memphis Undercover with Nancy.